Okay, I was told that I don't have to ask you to ask questions during the talk, but please do interrupt. And, you know, I told Terry Waugh that I was going to talk about single molecule unfolding, and he said to please first talk about the general problem of RNA secondary structure and tertiary structure to. He wanted a review to get started, so I will start with general things. And this has two purposes. One, to remind you that RNA is in the middle of molecular biology and takes the information stored in DNA and translates it, or it is allows it to be translated into the protein sequence. But what is really very true is that the knowledge of RNA structure is so much less than that of either DNA or protein. And I don't really know why that is, but I hope that what I'm told is that you all want to find out about problems that you can solve. And so I hope that this will encourage you to, you know, do the easy things first where there has been least done, namely RNA. What is the optimum goal? And I would say, given the sequence of the RNA, because sequences are coming out, you know, millions of base pairs and millions of bases a day, given the sequence of the RNA, predict its folded structure in any environment, like a cell. But more important, the reason that we want to know the structure is to be able to predict the function. So I tell you the sequence, you immediately say, oh, it folds up this way, and from its three-dimensional structure, it obviously has that function. So let's talk about some of the things that RNA does. So it does both good and bad things. Let's start at the top. So, okay, it causes diseases. RNA viruses cause a lot of diseases, and there are two types of RNA viruses. The most popular one right now is a retrovirus, HIV. And retrovirus just means, the nomenclature is that it is replicated by first forming DNA. So retro means that it goes from the RNA, information goes back into DNA, and then it is read as a DNA back into the RNA. So retrovirus in its life cycle goes through a DNA intermediate. And, you know, this is one of the unpleasant parts of the HIV, that it's an RNA virus, gets made into DNA, and then that DNA can be incorporated in the host, in whatever the HIV infects, so that the DNA as part of the host gets replicated when the host cells replicate. Then there are real RNA viruses that don't go through a DNA intermediate at all, that we call them plus and minus strands. And the plus strand, say, is the infective agent, but when it infects somebody, it is a minus strand copy, that is a complementary copy, is made, and then from that minus strand, many more plus strands are made. Okay, so we want to understand the RNA so we can control what the control how they act, namely prevent the viral diseases. Now, those RNA viruses, therefore, are the genome of the organism, of the virus, but they also have to code for proteins that are needed for viral replication, such as HIV makes the protease, and so protease inhibitors keeps the virus from continuing. So the RNA virus is also the message for synthesis of all proteins. And of course, in all cells, there are a lot of the RNA is messenger RNA, and it codes for the proteins. The machinery for translating the information is also made of RNA. That's the ribosome, is half RNA, half protein. And the most recently discovered function of RNA is as an enzyme, that is a catalyst. And there are various both naturally occurring functions that the RNA can catalyze, and we can make particular sequences that will catalyze other other reactions. I mentioned the ribosomal RNA, and the actual enzyme that makes a peptide bond, that makes a peptide bond in a protein, is the RNA, not the protein. The structure of ribosomes have just been determined at pretty high resolution by X-ray diffraction, and they've provided just a tremendous amount of RNA structural information which people are trying to understand. Say that again, the who's? The viral RNA, the viral RNA, when it infects one, brings in the message to make the enzyme that replicates it. So that, yes, that there are not enzymes that are specific for these RNA viruses, but part of the message in the RNA virus is for a RNA polymerase, an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. That's the first thing that happens. So here is a viral messenger RNA, call it the plestran. It infects a cell. That RNA is translated into proteins, you know, 3, 10, few proteins. One of those proteins is an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase that can start making more RNA. In the HIV, so the RNA, the viral RNA, uses mainly host enzymes. It can't carry all the information, but it carries the information for the ones that are vital to it. HIV brings in an RNA polymerase, a protease, integrase. The integrase is the enzyme that, after the HIV RNA has been made into double-stranded DNA, integrates it into the host cell. So, you know, that's a good point, that these viruses don't have very many genes. They just have enough to make them survive and be replicated in the host, and then they use all the rest of the host machinery for making things. Okay, so this is just any messenger RNA, and people used to think, maybe one of the reasons that, you know, I say that very little is known about RNA structure compared to protein structure, and protein structure has been studied greatly, partly for drug design. And so nearly all of the drugs that are used target proteins. People are working on drugs that target RNA, where you need to know the RNA structure and to find a drug specific for it. But one reason that people weren't interested in the structure of the RNA is that it was thought, for this messenger RNA, for example, that the only thing that was important was the sequence. Didn't matter what the three-dimensional structure was, because the sequence, what was important was this ribosome start signal that tells the RNA to bind to a ribosome. AUG always means start protein synthesis. Then you have all of the three-letter codes that code for the protein sequence, and then you have the three stop signals. And so people say, doesn't matter, you know, this is read as a linear sequence, and so the sequence is important. The three-dimensional structure is not important. But what has been learned is that there are a lot of control structures present in the 5' UTR means untranslated region, and 3 prime untranslated region. And these control how much protein is made, whether this thing gets translated or not. There are signals that determine how long this remains in the cell. Some messenger RNAs are chopped up very fast, others are very stable. There are structures in that sequence that is between the start and the stop that control how fast the protein is made, and also do programmed control of frame shifting. Now, we say that the messenger is a sequence of 3-letter codes, each of them standing for a protein amino acid. And so there is a phase of which those 3 bases should be read, which is determined by the start signal. But if as the ribosome is reading the signal, it gets out of phase, then it would start making a completely different protein. And you know, normally this is fatal to the protein being made. HIV is a messenger RNA that has a programmed frame shifting signal. It goes along and makes 1 protein, it goes back 1 nucleotide, and then starts making a different protein in different phase. It does this twice. There are 2 programmed frame shifts. So the point of this is that it isn't just the sequence, but the structure. And by that I mean that you can change the sequence, which doesn't change the structure. You can change an AU-based pair to a GC-based pair, and it'll have the same function even though the sequence has been changed. Questions? Yeah. Oh, sure. No. Normally, the way the protein is made is you start here, you read to the stop signal, and that terminates the protein. So that's the end of the protein. Let's say it makes it 100 amino acids long. In HIV, it makes what is called a polyprotein, in which there are 3 different proteins all connected to each other. And these 3 proteins are the ones that I mentioned, protease, integrase, and polymerase. And it's made as 1 big protein, and then the protease chops that big polypeptide into 3 separate proteins. And one of the reasons, you know, that we explain why the HIV does this is that normally, it would grab the ribosome here, be read here, and then fall off the ribosome. As soon as it falls off, it's got to compete with all the other cell messenger RNAs to come back on and start again. This way, it never lets go of the ribosome. It makes all these 3 proteins together. Well, that's one reason, so it doesn't have to give up the ribosome and compete again with all the messenger RNAs. The other thing is that this polyprotein is packaged as 1 unit part of the protein coat of the virus, so that it packages all its necessary enzymes and in the right ratio. That is, this frame shifting, program frame shifting, occurs the first time 10% of the time, the second time about 10% of the time, so that the ratio of these proteins is 1/10 to 1/100. And then it takes this polyprotein and it wraps around the RNA, and this is part of the package of the HIV. So it's very carefully controlled. If you change that ratio, the virus doesn't package right, it doesn't survive. Yeah.
Is the program actually in the sequence itself, or in the HIV, you said it's a messenger RNA?
Well, it is. Yeah, no. So the program shift depends on formation of a pseudonaut, and it's shown that carried pseudonym knots with me, but that so the RNA forms, well, this is a way to make my pseudonaut. It is the, you know, it's not really a knot at all, but if there was one full turn, then it would make a, what the non-mathematician, geez, the non-mathematician would call a knot. But can't do it. So it would make something like this, but the ends are not contained, connected. But the pseudo knot is, you start with a hairpin, saying has been used so much that the it no longer sticks. Anyway, that pseudo knot looks something like this. And what you can, we and a lot of others have studied the frame shifting caused by the pseudonauts. And if you break the base pair so that you no longer have the pseudonaut, you lose the frame shifting, but you can make it come back by making a base pair. It doesn't matter what the sequence is, just as long as it's a base pair, and you regain that frame shifting.
People.
Say that again, what?
Lifetime of mRNA, you said usually for normal lifetime, not shorter.
Yeah.
Is that message coding?
No. No. You know, the lifetime of the whole messenger RNA may be half an hour to many hours.
Yeah, but you said the other type of RNA are more stable, less longer.
Well,
mRNA program.
No, all right, no. Look, some mRNAs, you have to control, the cell has to control how much protein is made. And the main way the amount of protein being made is controlled is how long this messenger RNA lasts. It is synthesized and then there are exonucleases that start chewing it from either end, and there are endonucleases that cut. And some seem to have a structure which is very compact and is not cut by the enzymes, and others seems to have signals that say, you know, eat me, that tell the enzyme to chew them up, so that just in cells, the messenger RNA have very different lifetimes.
So in some sense, the structure of mRNA actually has to do with its lifetime.
Yes, no, for sure, for sure. Yes?
Is it known that you produce 9 times one protein and then the 10th time with the other one?
No. We don't know. What you measure is that 90% of the time it stops. See, what happens is that whenever it sees one of these three, one of these triplets, it will stop and fall off. The protein will be made. When there is a frame shift, what happens is that it moves back one, and so instead of seeing UGA, it sees UUG, for example, which is some amino acid, and then continues. So what we measure is just the ratio of the various proteins made, and we say that they're 100 to 10 to 1. We don't know. So, you know, we were hoping that maybe it was the stability of the pseudonaut. And so if you stabilize the pseudonaut, then instead of happening only 10% of the time, it would happen 50% of the time. It doesn't, well, if you make any very serious changes, you just stop the synthesis. And you cannot even do this over a wide temperature range. All of the synthesis is done in things like chicken reticulocyte cells or rabbit reticulocyte cells. And so it is a very complicated mess that has to have all of the amino acids, transfer RNAs. So I'm saying it's not a simple system. It is, you take a cell extract and you put in your messenger RNA and see what happens. So we would like to study this much more in much more detail. Now the structure of the ribosome has been determined, at least for prokaryotes, not eukaryotes. The thought, and it's only a thought, is that the messenger RNA interacts with something in the ribosome. That is, it could be either on the ribosome or so-called soluble factors, other proteins. And so, you know, we tried to do experiments such as cross-linking the messenger RNA to the ribosome to see what it was interacting with. And that it cross-links to a lot of places. It's not. Now, so we would like to study this by single molecule methods, which where you could answer your question. If you have a single ribosome with a messenger RNA and you watch it go through. Yeah.
How much overlap is there for these three particular protein coding regions?
Well, no, you know, it's a minus one frame shift.
So that's all it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there are two minus one. There's a minus one frame shift just before this stop, and then it happens again. And it happens, all of the retroviruses do this, you know, human, simian, et cetera. So it's just a minus one frame shift. Yeah. Well, so then that would be a plus one frame shift, and well, so all right, so you can have plus or minus one that would get you out of phase, or plus or minus two. If you have, if you jump three, then you just drop an amino acid and. Okay, so I think the point has been well made that the structure is important, not just the sequence, and we'd like to understand that. So why not say from the sequence we want to be able to, yes?
Is the formation of pseudonaut, is the bond energy comparable to KT? Are there thermal fluctuations that make them?
Well,
and if so, is the ratio of the protein formation highly sensitive to temperature?
Well, no, you can, by heating it, for sure you can melt it. That is, that the bond energies are not very large compared to KT. Well, the pseudonauts that are responsible for this frame shifting in normal, let's say, physiological conditions will melt, I don't know, 50 or 60 degrees. But at room temperature, that means that only a small percent of the time would they be melted. So say that we wanted to do temperature-dependent studies, but could not. I think there's more to it than just the thermodynamic stability, but I'm sure it's part of it. yeah.
So they're actually seeing these pseudonauts?
Well, what do you mean seeing them?
What do you mean? I mean, you know these pseudonauts are there, or you don't know?
Oh, no. We know that they're there, sure. We know that they form without the ribosome. That is, that we study the fragment of the RNA. We don't work with a whole HIV, but we just work with, let's say, 100 nucleotides or even 1,000 nucleotides. You can tell that the pseudonaut is there because it reacts chemically very different than if it was unbonded, so that you can use reagents that react differently with loops or with base-paired single-strand or double-strand region. We just took that sequence and made just the sequence that forms a pseudonaut, let's say 20 nucleotides, and used nuclear magnetic resonance to get a complete three-dimensional structure of just that sequence, not with the rest of it.
So it may not occur in the longer sequence.
Oh, no, it does occur in the longer sequence, because that way, the way we test for it there is with chemical reactivity. That is, you take the whole long sequence, 1,000 nucleotides, you react it with some reagent that will only react with the single strands, let's say some bases in the single strands, and then you can find out which bases reacted and which didn't. So you can tell, yes, that this is a base paired region and this is a loop region from its chemical reactivity in this long sequence. Well, no, it isn't the only, it is consistent with the reactivity, and you mutate it to either remove the base pairs or replace them by others and see that the frame shifting is consistent with the pseudonaut. I mean, that's the way it was found first. And, you know, the way I got into pseudonauts, Harold Varmus was at UC San Francisco, and he works on viruses, cancer-producing viruses, and he had determined that pseudonaut was present in the virus he was studying, which is mouse mammary tumor virus. And so he called and said, how would you like to do this structure, you know, collaborate on the NMR? And so that's what got us into making just the small sequence and determining its structure to atomic resolution. Okay, so I'm just saying that there's only four different bases in RNA. Thymine is in DNA, it just differs by a methyl from the uracil. So that the building blocks of the RNA are very simple. These are all aromatic planar molecules. They just have nitrogens and oxygens for their reactive groups. And again, simpler than proteins, even though some people disagree what's simpler, is that you only have a ribose phosphate backbone, all the same simple polymer, only the bases are different. The ribose has the OH, deoxyribose has the proton. So I would claim for any computational theorist that given the sequence and such a simple structure, you should be able to predict how it folds. Now, why not? Why isn't it? Seriously, I mean, what have you got? You've got electrostatics. We all understand that. Only four different bases. So I think it's just that people haven't put enough effort into it. Okay, so the other point to make here is that, just to remind you, that this chain has a directionality. So it goes from 3 prime to 5 prime, 5 prime to 3 prime, but just that the sequence going one way makes a difference which way the chain goes. And, you know, when I say predict the structure, it is, I give you the sequence and you tell me if it folds this way or any other way. And we don't have to, I mean, it's not necessary to know every bond length and bond angle. We assume that they are nearly constant. That is, it takes a lot more energy to change a bond length than a bond angle. But all we need to specify its conformation, how it's folded, are 7 torsion angles per nucleotide unit. So saying that you can assume constant bond lengths and roughly constant bond angles and just specify those torsion angles. Yes?
I'm thinking about transfer RNA where you also have counter where you have different metals that are
Yes, well,
no, yeah. I'm just wondering how many other things are involved.
Proteins. Are there any proteins involved in structure at all as well? Not for the transfer RNAs. No, I think it is mainly naked RNA. I'm trying to think what, you know, there are a lot of proteins that interact with the messenger RNA. It's got to find the ribosome, and the ribosome has to find it. So its end has to be there. Now, I should have said that. The RNA is transcribed from the DNA, but before it becomes a messenger RNA, there's a lot of processing. Introns are removed for eukaryotes, capping, that is. So various reactions occur on the messenger or on the pre-messenger RNA, so that there is a lot of interaction with proteins, but as far as I know, it doesn't exist as a protein RNA complex.
Are there any other chemical modifications that occur? I think of, for instance, the protein that you have carbohydrates.
Yeah, well, like, you know, transfer RNA is the most highly modified RNA because a lot of the bases are changed, they're methylated, they are really lots of changes. Messenger RNA is not modified, as far as I know. Ribosomal RNA has methyl groups attached, like 2'-O-methyl, that instead of 2'-hydroxyl, you put a methyl there. But it really, compared to proteins, I think there's much less modification on the RNA. Now, what you mentioned, though, which I think is crucial, is the metal ions. Magnesium ion, in particular, is involved in RNA folding.
Yeah, I have a similar question. So, does one know, for example, the folding pattern depends on the counter-ion concentration in the body?
Yes. Now, I was at Stanford, it's 2 weeks ago, and heard Dan Hirschlag talking about the folding of a ribozyme, the group 1 ribozyme. And so he collaborates with Steve Chu, and they were doing single molecule fluorescence energy transfer. But what he found was that if you, he would start the RNA in an unfolded state and then fold it with magnesium and sodium chloride, so that the folding was always under the same conditions, but the initial state was different because he'd start in different salt conditions. And he found that both the folding kinetics was very different and the fraction that formed a native fold, that is, that I think he found two mismatched folds and the native one, and the amount of each that he ended up with depended on the initial states, even though the folding was always under the same conditions of sodium and magnesium. So that the answer is yes, the folding does, well, so kinetics are important and the folding path depends on the initial state and of course on the folding conditions too. Of the ones that are known, no. As far as I know, transfer RNA is the most modified. You know, Gary, if I'm saying wrong things, speak up. Don't, whether they're right or wrong, comment, because you know more about molecular biology. But the transfer RNA is the most highly modified. Ribosomal RNA is somewhat modified. Say, I don't know of messenger RNAs being modified. Yeah.
I would argue that this is more complicated than a protein, because a protein only has two the rotating bond.
No, well, yeah, for the backbone, yeah, but what about the side chains? Well, they're important.
But with and the if lifted on the chondrin plot for amino acids, those freely rotating dihedral angles aren't all that freely rotating. Yeah, because yeah. Constrained.
Well,
how
sure.
Highly constrained are these?
Well, you know, the delta is highly constrained because of the five-membered ring, and so there's mainly just two positions for it, which are called 2' endo and 3' endo, just which is up or down. So that's the most highly constrained, as you might imagine. The chi angle, again, has two main ranges, which essentially just differ by 180 degrees, and most of the time it's in one form or the other. You know, the others have maybe more variability than Ramachandran plots that keep you pretty constant.
What's the persistence length of unfolded
mRNA? The persistence length is about 10 nanometers. No, I'm sorry, 10 angstroms, 1 nanometer.
So only a few residues.
Very few residues. No, for the single strand, you say it's not stiff at all. No. And it's, the persistence length is not very well known. We're interested in that.
Could it be in vivo, these molecules have a unique native pose?
Well, you know, unique is what worried about, that a lot of these RNAs do change their conformation. Like ribozymes do this, or ribosomes, so that they are, there may be fairly large motions. And what we do know about the structure, you say that they, it doesn't cost much energy to change from one conformation to another. And so they may be generally more flexible than proteins, which, Maybe good or bad, and I'm sure that they do change their conformation depending on when they interact with proteins. And if people have studied the free RNA structure and then with a complex with a protein, and you do see, let's say, major changes, that if the free molecule looks like this when it binds to a protein, it may do that. So, you know, maybe another part of answering that question, there have been calculations, and I'm trying to think of the name of the person, Ann, somebody in Wisconsin, Gary, do you remember Ann somebody? Anyway, no, okay, that using Michael Zucker's program for calculating RNA structure takes, let's say, viral RNAs, 10,000 nucleotides, calculates the structure using a program like Zucker's, which gives you minimum free energy and then the less optimal free energies. And what you can do with that is say what fraction of the time, so that is each of these free energies calculated gives you a different conformation. So you this is all calculation, not experimental. But what you find is that parts of the messenger RNA are very stable in that their free energy is so low that you'll always find this structure, while the rest may be very flexible. So that she says some parts of the RNA calculated to be very stable and not change at all, while other parts are that they can be very variable. And then she finds that the parts that are very stable, usually you can relate it to a biological function. So what I'm saying is that some parts of the molecule where it's important to have this structure are very stable and always have it, and others where it's less important to have structure are variable.
Jacobson?
No. I'm sorry, I can't. She's in Wisconsin. That'll help. Well, you know, whether proteins or RNA are easier is really irrelevant. Both are surely worth doing, and what is true, though, is that there are a lot more people folding proteins than RNA, so therefore you should do it. Yes?
One question is, there are variations in stability of regions. How coupled is the flexibility with the relative activity? In other words, is it queued up in the flexible regions and not?
Yes, yes.
So that one of the major determining factors in the...
Yeah, the single strands are more susceptible to nuclease activity, to any kind of chemical reactivity, so that any part that is folded up is more stable.
The fact that there's so flexible means that the cell isn't really concerned about...
Maybe, yeah, maybe. It's nearly time to take a break. Okay, let me quickly go through. This is a... Maybe people will not agree that, say, the base pairing can be predicted with good accuracy, and that just depends on what you call good accuracy. But this prediction is based not really on theory, but just people have measured the thermodynamic stability of double strand regions, loops, and bulges, and then you just add them up to calculate a free energy. So it is, say, not a theory in terms of using calculating forces and interactions. You just measure a lot of model compounds, and Doug Turner at the University of Rochester is the person that's done the most on this. And with that, those thermodynamic data using programmer Michael Zucker, you can calculate, and good accuracy means that you get a lot of, maybe 90% of the base pairs right. And but whether you get the right structure overall or not is depends on the molecule. And so the base pairing, I just want to again remind you, so the Watts and Crick are at the top. And the plus and the minus indicates the direction of the strands. So this is for anti-parallel strands. And GU was the next most common, and it fits into a double helix the way Watson and Crick helices do. But all of these bases can pair with all of the others. And I just showed two others here, namely that every one of the bases can pair with itself and pair with all the other bases, and in more than one way. So you can have an AU Watson-Crick or an AU reverse Hoogstein, lots of things. So all the bases can pair with all of the others. The Watson-Crick ones are the ones that fit into a nice helix. Part of predicting the structure, if you know it's a helix, the structure is very well defined. It's an A-form helix. We know how many base pairs per turn. We know the geometry. So if I tell you that I have a series of three or four Watson-Crick helices, then you know what the structure of that helix is. And this is notation. I've been talking about secondary structure, which is defined as the base pairing, and those are those lines between the circles, which are the bases. And tertiary structure we define as anything that involves chord crossing. And this was this definition, just because different people use different definitions of secondary and tertiary structure, this definition, ruling out tertiary structure, is what allows the Zucker program to do a good job of predicting secondary structure. If you leave out chord crossing, you can systematically consider all the possible base pairing schemes. As long as you don't have the chord crossing, you can look at all possible base pairs and then evaluate their free energy. As soon as you allow chord crossing, the number of possibilities increases much more. So And I said you can predict secondary structure. It's this sort of structure. And look, seen in, this is, so the same picture that I showed, the secondary structure is just regular base pairs, including one here I think we had. But the tertiary structure is the real folded state of the molecule and involves base triples and interactions between the secondary structures. That's a, you know, that's a tRNA, and it shows all of the modifications, methylations, pseudouracil, that Y base is highly modified. This is the most modified of the bases. Maybe more notation that I'll use. Just we use G for free energy, Gibbs free energy. So this is, H is enthalpy, E is energy, and that we try to minimize the free energy, and this is, has various purposes, so that the start out with a single strand. In the presence of sodium ion, you can form secondary structure, but you need usually either very high concentrations of sodium or divalent ion to form the tertiary structure. And this shows that it isn't until you get the tertiary structure that you can read the function, which I hope you can read. But, okay, so you need to know the tertiary structure to understand the function. And what we hope is that we can, in doing the prediction, that you can do it in these two steps. That is, we would like to be able to, say, use Zucker program to calculate secondary structure, and then from, and the program gives you a range of secondary structures corresponding to different free energies, that from those possible secondary structures to then consider how folding can continue to give a tertiary structure. Now, what we found is that that simple, or that hoped for hierarchy doesn't hold. That is, that in some cases, it mainly holds, but in some cases, in order to form the tertiary structure, you break and change some of the secondary structure. Yeah? No, because in the messenger RNA, there is no modification. It was just that transfer RNA that is, you know, highly modified.
And the ones that it loses, but do they tend to be the weaker ones?
Well, sure, you know, that if there is, let's say, 6 Watson-Crick base pairs in a row, then it's stable and you find it. It is when there are 3 or 4 and other, that either you can form these or you can form those, and then you don't get it right. So, long base paired regions, there's no question.
In real biological RNA, how often do you find these long ones?
Well,
distribution of the length of these.
Yeah, I don't know the, you know, you have all sorts. I mean, you don't really have 100 in a row, in fact, you don't have very many in a row, but sometimes there are just minor interruptions, like one mismatch or one bulge space, and again, you can predict those pretty well from the Zucker program. And all of this prediction is just based on having models to do it. But, yeah?
You mentioned that the secondary structure is very dependent on solving conditions.
Yes.
So if you change the solid conditions, is it that you change between having a structure and not having a structure, or do you get modifications that have different structures than
Well, usually the as you reduce the salt, you go to the single-stranded region. So all that phosphate repulsion takes over. So I think you have to have enough, high enough concentration of counterions to allow the, let's say, the attractive forces, the hydrogen bonds, the base stacking to take over. The other thing is that there are specific magnesium binding sites, and they're formed when the secondary structure forms, and they allow the magnesium to bind at particular places.
But you never get alternative structures under.
Well, no, I won't say. I'm trying to think of any examples. I don't know of any that for sure that going from adding magnesium, well, will give you this structure, and if you remove it, you'll go back to that structure. So that's alternative structures, sure.
Suppose I increase concentration of magnesium even further.
Yeah.
Will I go beyond native structure? Will it shrink?
I would think so, and you get aggregation. When you get magnesium, then two of them will come together. Cool. And
if I keep concentration very small, still playing.
I'm sure it will. I'm sure that things that might be flapping out will come in, so that it is a polyphosphate anyway, that it has all those phosphate charges, and so the higher the concentration of magnesium, the more you're going to compact it, I'm sure.
Has it been studied?
Not in detail that I know. No, isn't it time for a break after we get? Is that, I mean, can we,
huh?
It's 11, yeah, okay. We can, that's convenient.
That's 10 minutes.
10 minute break.
Yeah.
I see what you mean about not getting very far.
Nobody studied this?
More multivalent compliance, say, spermine or spermidine?
Well, people have added spermine, and I think you mainly get aggregates. If you worked at very low. Not with.
You may know more details about this than I do. When Norman Pace was originally, so there's this RNase peak.
Ribozyme.
Ribozyme. In vivo, it functions. There's a protein and an RNA component. Nobody knew which was the catalytic activity. What he showed was you could actually remove the protein
and add a lot of
work to give catalysis, but you had to raise the salt concentration a lot, very high magnesium.
Yeah.
And the idea was that the protein was acting to do
so
the
beyond the standard.
Right. So in normal physiological magnesium,
that's a good question.
You remove the protein and you could increase the magnesium, and now it would work by itself.
I forgot about that. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Well, what people say is that in early evolution it was magnesium that did things, and then the protein came to take over and be more specific. But that's a good point.
Who is the main player? Who are main players in this thing? Playing with spermine and spermidine magnesium.
Victor Bloomfield has done spermine and spermidine on DNA. DNA.
I am actually from Minnesota.
From Minnesota. Okay.
So
So he's done things with DNA.
DNA. About DNA.
All right. But he mentioned Norman Pace, but that wasn't spermine. I mean, that was just magnesium. So I don't know anybody doing it with RNA.
I wanted to ask you something about tRNAs. We looked in doing calculations, and with looking at suboptimal states. And if you remove the modified basis, you get many more suboptimal states, which is easy to understand because you have additional base currents.
Yes.
So don't you think that the modifications have to do to with the stability, it, with the stability of the structure? To freeze it more into the
right state. Structure. Yeah. Now, why is it mainly on tRNAs? They're the only ones that need to be.
But the tRNA has to fulfill many constraints simultaneously. It has to fit to the amino acid synthetase ribosome binding sites and so
it has a lot of function. It's interesting. No, I mean, just the fact that it can do all of these different functions, and it's to interact with something specific and some things with the ribosome non-specifically.
How much is known about this Selena cysteine business of the messenger RNA?
I don't know.
I saw some papers 2 or 3 years ago, but then very little in the near past.
I don't know. I mean, do not.
It's a very nice talk what you're doing. However, you don't go very far.
No, I know.
What I realized yesterday, I prepared about twice as much. Very good questions, lovely discussion.
Yeah.
2 hours are gone.
No, that's the thing with it's a very mixed group. I'm sure some people are very familiar and others are, so you're not convinced that RNA is easier than proteins.
Well, there's the more degree. Yes, I'm not. The more degrees of freedom in the backbone, and the energy, the degeneracy is greater, right? Because there's so many more ways to arrange things. Although you're making arguments for the second instruction.
Depends what you're thinking about. The base complementarity helps you a lot.
Yeah, sure. That's why. See, that we already know the secondary. You know, the protein people hear these. The alpha helices aren't stable except. They're not stable by the cell.
True, your points are well taken. So for secondary structure, the base pairing doesn't matter that much because the sequence degeneracy is low. And so the base pairing degeneracy doesn't matter. But that's for secondary structure. But for tertiary structure, base can form here. And from a chemical perspective, it doesn't seem as specific as side chain packing. Well, the van der Waals issues aren't so great.
On the other hand, much more is known about protein structures.
Yes.
And so the tertiary interactions in RNA, whenever there's a new crystal structure,
the ribosome structure gave us. I mean, it's a quantity. More than double. I mean, like 3 or 4 or 5 times. And people are still analyzing that. There's so many protein structures, right? And the RNA, we're just getting them.
I like this one to solve everything first principles.
Oh, good.
So having all the structures, those are empirical methods.
Yeah, right. No, so see that they don't have to be constrained by experimental data. Here, just do it, right? Just predict the structure and the function. Don't mess around.
It was Dan Herzog's kinetic data that finally convinced me that degeneracy does play a big role in the kinetic process in the folding of RNAs. So small proteins fold without any intermediates, presumably because there's just no degeneracy, so there are no misfolded states that are stable, there are no partially structured states that are stable, it's an all-in-one process. But with RNAs, the kinetic process invariably has misfolding events and partially folded states. That's just, from my perspective, an overwhelming force.
His experiments are interesting, that is it.
And nicely robust. It's very clear that that there are these intermediates really are there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Some of them really are on path, some of them really are off path.
It's
a very complicated system from my limited perspective.
Now, the question is, how much of all this is important for the biology? For the no, that is, that does this, the all of the foline experiments we do, or Dan Hirschlag does, are very artificial compared to how the RNA is being synthesized and folded as it.
Well, in fact, in protein folding case, we face that same criticism.
Yes.
You can unfold proteins in lots of different denaturants and generate different unfolded ensembles, and always get back, basically always get back the same folding kinetics. So I suspect that we're studying in vitro is similar to what we're studying in what happens in vivo. And moreover, there is this Leventhal paradox: folding kinetics and proteins and RNAs, I assume, should be difficult. It's not. It's 50 or 80 or 100 orders of magnitude faster than it should be.
Yeah, no, but
and I that's solved in vitro should be super vivo.
Yeah, no, but I don't. You know, I think the Cyrus Leventhal paradox is a straw horse or whatever it is.
Sure, it's just a.
Is it a straw horse? Is that what it is?
Because we're here in protein.
It wasn't the time when he said it.
Yeah.
It caused people to think.
Yeah, good.
It,
yeah,
that
yeah,
was
yeah,
the function.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
But you cannot assume that you have a complete plane in energy, and then you have to to look for a hole like in a golf course.
Leventhal himself mentions these issues in his papers, but it's a convenient way of encapsulating the problem. Why isn't it a golf course landscape? What tricks is evolution invented?
Sure, that's what I meant. It caused people to think about it, and so it was very useful. But when you're in retrospect. It was just
naive. Sure. Again, I'm just rereading his papers recently, actually, a week or so ago. His papers aren't so naive because he says clearly this is not true. But let's ask why it's not true. What are the mechanisms?
I'm wondering whether you have one of these examples in proteins. There's a small RNA which is used in replication by Q-beta. It's an artificial protein.
Yes, yes.
And it has a quite stable. Metastable conformation, which is the one which is replicated. And it can form another one, which is the thermodynamically favored structure, which is not replicated. And that's the reason why you can really distinguish between the two. Christoph Pibrich did that work. Mm-hmm. And when you fold the molecule, you form not more than 10% of the thermodynamically stable conformation. So you fold the majority as the other one which replicates. But if you do it carefully, you realize that you are losing all those part of your molecules and you are accumulating. Do you have a similar example in proteins?
There's the serpins, which is a protein that folds up to form a kinetically trapped intermediate with a beta sheet, where one strand's misplaced out of register relative to the thermodynamic, and that slowly shifts over. And it's thought that that's a biological clock, right? Like how long the protein is active, because when it flips over the thermodynamic.
When you compute with the base pairing pattern with the secondary structures, you see that the energy difference in this case is huge. It's 15 kilocalories per mole. But the thermodynamically favored, kinetically disfavored structure is more stable. So it never. It never
goes back.
By itself goes back. Okay.
We have before the end of your talk. Okay. To chat with you more this afternoon or tomorrow. Do you have a room? Office here?
I will have one, but I don't know where it is. I was going to do it afterwards.
Seated again, so that we can go on. And I also want to remind those people who may not have been here at the beginning of the talk that the afternoon session was set at 1:30 as opposed to 2:00.
I'm going to get to single molecule stuff in a minute, but I'll just finish. These are the secondary structure, structural motifs, if you like, which people have measured thermodynamics of so that they can add them up to be able to predict a secondary structure. So these are all elements of secondary structure which there are some thermodynamic data on, mainly from Turner's lab. So, and then here are examples of tertiary structure, so that there are always interactions between these secondary structure units. We talked about a pseudonaut at length, a this called kissing hairpins. I didn't design that or define that name, but it's just two hairpins that interact by Watson-Crick base pairs. This is a hairpin interacting with a bulge. I didn't point out that the difference between a bulge and an internal loop is that the base pairing is continuous on one strand, and then you just have bases sticking out. These occur a lot in messenger RNAs and ribosomal RNAs. It's a tetraloop and a tetraloop receptor. And you see that all of these bring a lot of phosphates close together, and therefore, to allow them to form, you either need, let's say, 5 or 10 millimolar magnesium ion or very high concentrations of sodium ions. The thermodynamics of a lot of them have been determined, and as a function of salt, because as a function of sodium and magnesium, let's say for the pseudonaut, what you find is that you add magnesium and a little bit of sodium, and it is stable. Normally, the more salt you add, the more stable any of these things are. But if you have the right ratio of magnesium to sodium, if you add more sodium ions to that pseudonaut, it comes apart because the sodium ion displaces the magnesium or the binding attraction for sodium magnesium is different in the double-stranded regions and for the pseudonaut. So that all of these, their formation does depend on the ionic strength and the ratio of sodium to monovalent to divalent ions. You know, when you say energy, it's always the free energy, and what you just measure is the fraction in one form or another versus salt or temperature. So that just... Yes?
In all elements you showed, hydrogen bonds are important.
Yes.
One can imagine that you have two hairpins and they come to each other just with the static force without hydrogen.
Yes. These are all held together by base pairing usually,
yeah.
But there are well-known examples, people have studied them, where you do form either triple strands or two helix-helix interactions, and the hydroxyls on the ribose can be involved in and are involved in base pairing, hydroxyl to phosphate. So that a lot of this that happens in RNA doesn't happen in DNA because of the 2' hydroxyl in the ribose.
But it is only chemically bond stabilized structures.
Chemical bond, like hydrogen bond,
yeah,
like
or something like that. It's never something where you can have electrostatics.
Well, no, but you. You do have. I mean, electrostatics are very important here, right? That you have to be able. All of these have a lot of phosphate charges all together there, and so you have an extra electrostatic repulsion, and you need divalent ions usually there.
Yeah. But in the case of helix-helix.
You do have helix-helix interactions.
And there still, you said, stabilized by hydrogen bond?
There is interaction.
In
the crystal that you have helix-helix interactions close, and you can see hydrogen bonds from the 2' hydroxyl to a phosphate of the other helix. Yes.
That interaction between bases along the strand play any role?
Sure. What do you mean? The stacking or?
Yeah, the stacking. There is a.
Sure.
And there is some interaction between bases along the strand. And activities damage important protein interactions in the form of.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not sure that. So, in something like this, it turns out the structure is more or less a continuous helix. You know, it looks, you don't see it here, but you can stack that helix on there with just a slight bend, so that there is continuous stacking here to this base pair with probably that G out. And so I'm not sure I understand the question, but that all of the interactions involve the base pairing, the stacking, both within the helix and between helices, either coaxial stacking or side-by-side interactions. And you also have intercalation of one base from a different part of the RNA into the base pair sometime into a helix.
My question was, is it a possibility to bend the RNA, or is it possible to bend on base sequence? Or?
Well, it seems, you know, unlike DNA, you don't have really long helical regions without interruption. Usually, when you have bends, it's because you have a bulge base or a mismatch, and that gives you a lot more flexibility, really. This is a molecule that we studied, which got us into the single molecule business, which I definitely want to talk about. So, we do NMR to determine three-dimensional structure, and we're limited in size. So this is 56 nucleotides, which is pretty big for an NMR structure. But this was what had been the secondary structure predicted by Zucker's program, thermodynamics. And we determined its secondary structure by NMR. You can see, well, now by NMR, when we did this, we didn't use this method. You can see directly hydrogen bonding between the C and G scalar coupling constants tell you that there is chemical bonding between the C and the G, or the U and the A, but we can determine the secondary structure, and we found that it was different from what's seen in the X-ray and what had been predicted from phylogenetics. Now, the phylogenetics just means you take a lot of sequences and you see if they can all be folded into the same secondary structure. These sequences have different base pairing in here, but you look for essentially sequences that can all fold into that structure, and this is this phylogenetics prediction. And what we found is that in this P5C, the base pairing was different, so that it just showed that the NMR and the thermodynamics gave a different secondary structure than the phylogenetics prediction and the X-ray structure. Now, the difference in our measurements were done in aqueous solution by NMR with just sodium ions added. And of course, the crystal structure, they do have magnesium, maybe they have spermine. Anyway, they have a lot more positive charges. So what we wanted to do is add magnesium to this solution to see if the secondary structure changed. And so that's just the secondary structure. The tertiary structure determined from the NMR is the following. So these are the extended as NMR, the crystal structure. I showed you those secondary structures before. These are the structures. This is a structure we determined by NMR. This was in the crystal structure. Our NMR structure we took out some base pairs here, which is why this thing that is in the crystal, there are more base pairs, but to compare it with ours, we just cut out the ones that are present in the crystal. Okay, so the difference besides the base pairing in that P5C is that in the crystal it's more compact. It is shows a lot of tertiary interactions there, that is, this A-rich bulge is interacting with the P5C. So this is the crystal structure. This is what we measured in solution in sodium ion. And so what we wanted to do is add magnesium and see if it went like that. The differences are this A-rich bulge is essentially turned inside out in the crystal to form base pairs over this, and clearly it's much more compact. But when we added magnesium to that solution, the NMR spectrum becomes uninterpretable. Namely, in the presence of magnesium, we get multiple species. We get more than one species that broadens all the NMR lines. You just can't interpret the spectrum. And we tried everything. When this often happens in RNA studies, that you have multiple species in solution, and so you try lowering the temperature, raising the temperature, adding magnesium, higher, lower. Anyway, we could not do anything to get away from the multiple species, and so decided that the only way to avoid multiple species is to look at one molecule at a time. And so one molecule has one conformation, yes, at one time. Well, when we added magnesium, that we could not interpret the whole NMR spectrum, but we could see that we had essentially some base pairing like this and some base pairing like that in the solution. So we had both of these. We might have other structures also, but there are a few NMR lines that were characteristic of this form and that form, and we could see that we had some of each.
Species for human folding.
Yes, yeah. But they're different, both secondary structure in this case and clearly very different three-dimensional structure. Yes?
And when you put the magnesium in, the conditions in the NMR2, how different were they in terms of these metal ions and such compared to the crystal?
Oh. Very little, because very, very different, because if you had the salt conditions, the crystal would all precipitate. It comes down, they add a lot of stuff to make it come, yes?
Do the magnesium ions go to specific sites, or you can just use the whole thing as magnesium reliving over a screening?
No, in the crystal, they see magnesiums at specific sites. So it isn't, and you don't want to have just magnesium. You have sodium to mainly counteract the phosphate, and then you have magnesiums in particular places. So in the crystal structure, and I have a slide that shows where they are in the crystal. For the same, I think there's five magnesiums in specific places. Yeah. Yes. Well, it is. No, it isn't. It can't be too floppy, or else we wouldn't be able to see it. Now, the NMR and this structure comes mainly from nuclear Oberhauser effect, which is a 1/6 distance, so that we have, let's say, good local structure here. We are trying to get better global structure, that is like the angle between this helix and that one and this one. And for that, what you do is partially orient the molecule, and then you can measure direct dipole-dipole interaction, which is 1/3. You know, if the molecule is freely tumbling, you average out the dipole-dipole interaction. So you see the 1/6 NOEs, but by partially orienting this molecule, you can measure dipole-dipole interactions between NH bonds here. You can get the angle between an NH bond here and an NH bond there. And so that'll give us better global structure. But from the NMR, this is, you know, this is just consistent with the NMR that fits all of the local NOEs around here. We know that this helix, again from the NMR, is more dynamic than these, so that, you know, it may be thinking about going to that. But okay, yes.
Yeah. Play any role in stabilizing?
Well, sure. I mean, you have to have enough sodium. If you reduce the sodium concentration, this would become more nearly single-stranded. And so this was done at 200 millimolar sodium. Yeah. Well, in the Zucker algorithm, it's just nearest neighbor interaction based on the model measurements made in 1 molar sodium chloride. And so you don't take, in Zucker algorithm, doesn't take into account any long range interactions. It's all. Yeah, no, and it predicts it completely. That is, it gives the right answer. This, say, is based on thermodynamic measurements. These are tetraloops, which are extra stable thermodynamically. And so this is what we see here in the crystal. This isn't a tetraloop. It's 5 nucleotides. And so it is not what you would measure or predict if just from secondary structure, but clearly it forms this because of all of this other interaction. Okay, I've got half an hour to tell you about single molecules.
I mean, you need more time.
I have enough time. Let me just tell you about this experiment, because this is all done in Professor Carlos Bustamante lab, and with an instrument made by Steve Smith. And these are just postdocs that did the work. And so it is laser tweezers. And so what you do is you have the chamber, which is the size of a microscope slide. You look through a microscope where you can see the 2 beads that are attached to the ends of the molecule you're going to study. One bead is held in the laser trap and the other bead on a micropipette, and you can move the micropipette with the piezoelectric device. And so what you say, all you see are the 2 beads. You can measure the distance between the beads, nanometers. You measure the force on this bead by how much it moves out of the center of the laser trap. That if there's no force, it's right in the center of the trap. If you pull on it, then how much it moves in the trap tells you the force that's applied. And so, this chamber, you can do it in any solvent you like, sodium, magnesium, proteins, ligands, whatever. And I didn't emphasize maybe enough that because we couldn't study this molecule in the presence of magnesium by NMR, we decided to go to single molecules where we would have at least at any one time one conformation. And in order to hold the molecule, the RNA molecule, we put 500 base pairs of DNA handles on either end. that moves the RNA away from the beads and allows us to attach, by standard methods, the DNA handles to the beads. And these are the RNA molecules that we looked at. This is what we did NMR on. P5ABC is part of a ribozyme. But we wanted to start with simpler things, so this just, we cut out that A-rich bulge, which is involved in the tertiary interaction. The greens are magnesium ions seen in the crystal, so that essentially it is involved in all of that tertiary interaction. It's necessary to allow that to become as compact as it is in, as seen in the crystal. And this is a simple hairpin, not quite simple. It has a U bulge there. It has two GA non-Watson Crick base pairs. So it's just this sequence. This is a naturally occurring sequence in tetrahymena ribozyme. And we started off with this simpler molecule. So this is what the force piconewtons extension curves look like. And this part is just straightening out the DNA handles. So if you didn't have the hairpin in there, this would just keep going up the way that does. So the black is the DNA handles. They're actually DNA-RNA hybrids. But this abrupt transition is where we say that hairpin is unfolding. And the reason for saying that is 18 nanometers corresponds to, we're breaking 22 base pairs. And so that's about right for per nucleotide. This unfolding curve is reversible. That is, that these are, I think, four curves superimposed going up and back, so that it is reversibly folded. And that means that the work done is a reversible work, force times distance. So this is just the free energy of unfolding, because it is reversible. And a piconewton nanometer is 10 to the minus 21 joules. If you multiply, I know physicists hate this, but if you multiply by Avogadro's number and divide by 1,000, you can get the answer in kilojoules per mole, which the or even kilocalories per mole, which electrobiologists, chemists like. And this 18 nanometers times the force of about 14 and a half piconewtons corresponds to 150 kilojoules per mole, which is, as you'll see in a minute, reasonable agreement with the Zucker prediction. And this is in magnesium. EDTA chelates the magnesium and removes it. Both of these are in 200 millimolar sodium chloride, so that all the magnesium does is make it more stable. This is with magnesium. Without magnesium, keeping the same sodium, you just reduce the force by about a piconewton, and that means you reduce the free energy by a few kilo. Well, no, let's see. You know, we get the distance between the phosphates and a nucleotide depends on the force you're applying, and it's about half a, it's actually 0.42 nanometers per nucleotide, so 4.2 angstroms it comes out. Yeah. The slope down here? We think that that is consistent with the spring constant on the laser trap. That is, the we're measuring points at 200 hertz, and so we think that's just the you're pulling on the bead when it's when all of a sudden the length increases, the force decreases, and that's, if you like, the bounce of the spring. And the spring is the laser trap. But you know, in order to interpret that as a free energy, it's got to be reversible, and the way to really show it's reversible is to hold the force constant and watch the length go between the hairpin and eventually the single strand. So here what we're doing is we are using force feedback to keep the force at constant value, and this is below the transition. As you come into the transition, you find that the length increases a small percent of the time. As you get closer to the midpoint of the transition, then you get more, nearly equal amounts hairpin and single strand. Here it's mainly single strand. So this just shows that it really is reversible. Yes? Yes, this is time, you know, 1 second. So this is whatever, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. So, right, we're just plotting length versus time, holding the force constant with a feedback to keep the force constant. And so, you know, this tells you that it really is at equilibrium, that you can jump back and forth between the hairpin and the single strand. And of course you can get an equilibrium constant just by measuring the total time it's in one form versus the total time it's in the other form. And again, the removing magnesium doesn't do much except lower the transition force by a piconewton or so. And I'm showing this, and I'm going to contrast it with what happens where there's tertiary structure. So here, there's only secondary structure. We think magnesium has no specific binding sites, that it just is acting like ionic strength. That is, that it has no other effect than reducing the electrostatic repulsion. It's not any specific effects, only secondary structure, a simple hairpin. Yes? We have talked about it. I don't know if it has been done. But you can do the experiment either way, as you say, keeping the force constant and watching the extension, and trying to keep the extension constant and keeping and watching the fluctuation in force. I don't know that we've done that. So this, I said that you could measure the equilibrium constant just from the fraction of time it spends in each form. And the reason the equilibrium constant changes with force is, of course, because the single strand is longer than the hairpin, and you expect the log of the equilibrium constant to be linear in force if the change in length was constant. So, you know, this is the same thermodynamics that you'd use with pressure and volume, and you get a good straight line, and you can get a delta L from this. So this is, here we're not measuring a length at all. We're measuring the fraction of time in each of the forms and plotting it versus force. But the length that comes out of this is 22 nanometers. What we had gotten as an average from actually measuring the length was 18 nanometers, and that's within experimental error. The length does depend on force, but here we just used made a linear fit. So both of these give you roughly the same answer for the length, and just go through that we measured the free energy, say by integrating the force times the change in length, and to compare it with, say, Zucker calculation, we have to go through this thermodynamic cycle to calculate the free energy at zero force. And the main difference is this at zero force, the single strand has a lot more entropy than the stretched out single strand. And so we estimated the effect of going from here to here by using the worm-like chain. And the worm-like chain does a very important parameter is the persistence length. And the persistence length for double-stranded DNA has been studied very extensively, but the persistence length for single-stranded RNA, people have made various estimates, but it's not really easy to measure because you need to have a single strand that has no base pairing, et cetera. And so there is, well, different people get different results. I think, well, yeah, you know, that's why we have not done this. We'll eventually is do oligo U and oligo A, but yes, the persistent. So for sure. But this is just rough measured free energy at this transition force, we say is 157 plus or minus 20. This worm-like chain correction for the entropy, we give it that. I put a big 10 kilojoules error on Zucker just because there are no good thermodynamics for these two GAs next to a UG. People have not measured that. Now, you know, we can't measure this at 25 degrees because it doesn't melt. That is, that people measure the free energy by melting at some temperature and then extrapolating. We tried to do measurements on this. For one thing, it isn't a two-state melting, so that you can't just melt it and get a good measure of its free energy. So we use Zucker. You know, this sort of agreement or disagreement doesn't bother me. That is, that I'm happy that the free energy at the at force is higher than Zucker's, or of course calculated one, so that it is all reasonable. I want to, essentially contrast that with, I've shown you this before, but just that I said we get equilibrium constant from it. That's what we talked about. Of course, you can also measure, get the kinetics. The kinetics is just from the average lifetime in this form, 1 over the average lifetime is a rate constant for unfolding. And if you take the average lifetime here, the reciprocal of that is the rate constant for folding. So that you get kinetics from this experiment as well as thermodynamics. And you can plot the, you know, I have my arrows going wrong. This should be, K1 is hairpin to single strand. But an analogous to the Arrhenius plot for the chemists in the audience, kineticists, that if you plot the rate constant versus force, you can get the length going from the initial state to the transition state. And this measured length is just about halfway between the completely folded and unfolded form, which, remember, that was 18 to 22 nanometers, and here it's 12. If you plot K minus 1 coming back, you get essentially, and again, halfway in between. Yes, I mean, we assume that it is just a first order kinetics, and it goes up and down as.
And you can look at,
it is consistent with first order kinetics. We don't have really a lot of data, but yes, that the lifetimes measured are consistent exponential. Yes.
Can you figure out the rhythm being used here and calculate what the transition state
is? A Zucker algorithm? No, I don't think so, because well.
Corrected with the various other entrants.
Yeah, well, I think that to do that you would have to have a good partition function for how it's unfolding. So you need a model of its unfolding, right? to tell you what is the top of that transition state. So I think that if you, well. In principle, I'm hesitating, but to write down the partition function and see where is the transition, where is the maximum in the free energy? I guess I don't know the answer as clear from my answer. Yes. Well, it has 22 base pairs. It is not very stable in the center, which may help to be only two, but we do not see any intermediates in this. Now, this is just sort of throwing out data, maybe throwing everything out. So I told you about the hairpin, which magnesium has no special effect. You see just that biphasic two forms. And now I'm going to switch to the real P5ABC that shows tertiary structure. So this is simple to say. This is complicated. And let's look at it. So this has a tertiary interaction, and the first thing, it is very irreversible. The blue is the unfolding. You go to high force, it unfolds, and this is about 30 nanometers, which is consistent with the number of nucleotides that you're breaking. The refolding, we say what's happening is the secondary structure is mainly forming here, and then you finally have this small transition. So in magnesium, very irreversible. And if you remove the magnesium by adding EDTA, then it becomes reversible without magnesium, and it follows essentially the green curve, which is the refolding curve. So in the absence of magnesium, folding and refolding is reversible, and it looks like refolding in the presence of magnesium. What that tells me is that the magnesium doesn't find the binding sites until most of the secondary structure has formed. There are no specific magnesium binding sites until the secondary structure. Say that again?
Refolding
of the green cube.
When you go down, you are really getting
folding again. No, in the magnesium, we finally come back to this, and then we can go there.
You get the folding
structure. Yes, I think so, yes. Because, the reason I say that it is the same one is because it unfolds at about the same place. Yes. So that this is when we did it at the normal unfolding rate. And so just the point is that we think that it refolds in the presence of magnesium, it refolds the same way as in the absence of magnesium. So magnesium doesn't come in until the thing has folded. So we could not, well, and I'll show you, I guess, just to illustrate, emphasize that it is not reversible, that in the presence of magnesium, as we move up, we don't see anything until it finally jumps from the hairpin to the single strand, and then it stays there. So we don't see anything reversible without magnesium. We see reversible, it isn't all the way, that is, we see. So intermediates in the absence of magnesium. We've only done one concentration and none, so we've got to do that. But eventually, well, I think that if we go to low enough magnesium, the hysteresis disappears, so that there's got to be some place where it changes. So now we can't measure, therefore, the rate of unfolding and the rate of refolding, but we can measure the unfolding by varying the pulling rate, as somebody asked. So this is just R is the rate of pulling, and we use two of them, one piconewton per second and 10 piconewtons per second. And this is just an equation that tells you how the kinetics should go when you have a force-dependent rate constant, and that force is being linearly increased by R. And if you, well, it's a complicated equation and not very accurate, well, not very precise data, but if you believe the straight line, you can fit it to a distance to the transition state of 1.6 nanometers instead of 12 nanometers. So what this says is that in the presence of magnesium in this folded tertiary form, that it only takes a small change in length to get you to the transition state. So it is much more like a protein unfolding, which has similar transition length. So say that if you like the terminology, this structure is brittle, while the simple hairpin is compliant. So, yes. Yeah. What? There are what? Terraces. I know. No, I see. I don't know if they're for real.
The other question is, when you're doing this experiment, what is the unfolded state? I mean, are you getting rid of the tertiary structure?
Yes. No. The unfolded state corresponds to a single strand. Yeah. And the length tells us that. Okay. So I will end, and this is a talk I usually give to chemists, and I'm ready to quit. I'm ready to quit. You can measure the work of unfolding. We're always measuring the work of unfolding. If we do it slowly enough, it is a free energy. But I think even when it isn't reversible, we can learn about things, just relative changes in the work necessary. And of course, you can change both the equilibrium constant and the rate constant, because the force affects both of those. And what I like about this is that you can study unfolding under your conditions. Namely, normally without force, you have to use temperature, you have to use a denaturing solvent. Here we can use any condition we like, have proteins in there, have ligands, and use force to unfold. magnesium has the biggest effect on kinetics rather than on thermodynamics. And we can measure the effect on thermodynamics, but the really marked effect on kinetics. And I put this because as an NMR person, we are really dependent on length. That is, adding two or three nucleotides makes the problem much more difficult. And here we have pulled on what I showed you, P5ABC, all the way up to, just to show you we can do it. This is a ribosomal RNA with 1,500 nucleotides. This was all without magnesium. With magnesium, it becomes much more complicated, but doesn't matter how big the RNA is. It can grab the ends and pull on it. Now, whether we can interpret this eventually, I don't know. We're going to add ribosomal proteins that are known to interact with this to see how it changes. Okay, thank you. Yes, I'm sorry, one question if you want. Go ahead.
You mentioned that you increase the magnesium concentration and everything becomes more stiff.
Yes. Yes.
It sounds a little counterintuitive.
It sounds what?
Counterintuitive because you are supposed to screen the interaction.
Well, all right, no, but you know, for the hairpin, you add magnesium, it doesn't become any more stiff. It's just screening. Yeah. But for the P5ABC with tertiary structure, we think that the magnesium binds in specific places, and that's what really stiffens it, not just the electrostatic screening. Yeah.
You mentioned that in some of the experiments we try to keep the force constant, but in fact that force is transmitted
through the DNA, yeah.
Which is itself maybe doing some thermal motor. So is that a big factor to worry about?
I hope not. The fluctuations in the DNA are small compared to the RNA, and you can see that because if you just pull on the DNA handles by themselves, then you can see in the slide that there's a little bit of noise, and that's, you know, random thermal noise. But when you get into that transition region where the RNA is really going from the hairpin to that, that's a big, big fluctuation. Yeah?
Can this be combined with single molecule spectroscopy?
Well, you know, we're talking about using fluorescence resonance energy transfer, and Shimon Weiss, if you know him at Berkeley, so the answer is in principle, yes, that you can do it. No, so you can see what's changing. I would like to do single molecule NMR. Anybody have any? Okay.
What is the longest time you probe?
No, essentially the drift is due to temperature changing in the room or something like that, but you can keep one molecule in one condition, say, for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that. Sure. Yeah, you know, because some of the things that for bigger molecules, bigger than the one we have here, that you unfold it, and then you let it refold. If you unfold again, it's clear that it hasn't completely refolded. So what you can do, unfold it, let it refold, and then wait a minute, give it a chance to do its kinetics. You know. So this is all 25 degree kinetics, room temperature kinetics, which is slower than people that do thermal melting. Yeah? Well, because I'm a chemist, so. No, you know, Whenever my students ask me something, I say, I don't know the answer, that's physics. And I'm sure the physicists could say the same thing, you know, that's chemistry. So,
you say? Calculate, for example, effect of magnesium on change of free energy.
Yes, but it's like the kind of continuous screening which we are thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's more specific.
More specific, you know, and so you cannot just start off with saying that I just take it as an average cloud or something.
No, that's for sure. So what the average cloud is physics, and specific binding is chemistry. Okay.
No more questions. I want to remind you again, we start at 1:30 this afternoon here in this room. Thank you again.
I'm staying here for today and tomorrow.